It's Wednesday, October 27th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 210 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Johan.
And this is Wayne.
Fear the Con 4, the website is now up. If you want to sign up, go out to fearthecon.com. The pricing is the exact same as last year. It's $25 a ticket to get in. And that ticket will... Go ahead, Pat.
When's it going to go on sale?
That depends who you are.
So I go out and check my PayPal account this morning because I was trying to remember if I had paid Jenny, who's doing some art for me. I was trying to remember if I'd paid her yet or not. And I noticed that there's $25 balance sitting in my PayPal account. And I'm like, where the heck did this money come from? So look at my payment history. I've already got a payment from Runester for Fear the Con 4. He just URL bashed his way out there and bought a ticket.
That is a super fan.
So if you want to be the first, you're too late. Yep. But anyway, fearthecon.com, and you can get the ticket for $25. It'll cover entry, all the games, beer and soda during the convention as long as it lasts, and it will cover your buffet food at Wing Night. Something I'm going to do this year a little bit differently, because I was talking to some people that were kind of concerned that some of the more in-demand games get put out early, and by the time someone who's later on can finally figure out that they're able to come, the ones they want are all full up. So this year, I'm going to trickle mine out. Instead of posting all of my games at once right now, I'm going to put out like one every couple months all the way up to the con, putting the last one up like a week or two before the convention hits so that a variety of people have a chance to get in. But this is a great con. The fans and the people that have showed up have just knocked it out of the park 3 years running. I have great confidence this fourth year. And if you are concerned about price in regard to travel or to rooms, there are tons of threads running about sharing the cost of rides and rooms. And I will be sure to put a link to that area of the forums for anyone that's interested. So with that said and done, let's roll right into our topics for today. This one actually was suggested right here from within my own household by Carla. As I've mentioned on the show, she's playing in my Friday D&D game. She's playing a half-elven ranger. Interesting character, but I won't bore you with stories about her character anymore.
Oh, you know they'd love it.
Maybe later.
Okay.
Maybe we'll have a characters and gaming stories bonus episode someday, but okay. It will not be right here and right now. But she brought up an issue, which is actually one that I have struggled with as well. When you play a role-playing game, you know that what's going on is fictional. It's completely imaginary. You know that the objective of the players is to play a character that requires role-playing, that requires them being someone they are not, or pretending to be someone they are not. But have you ever had trouble separating the actions of the character from the actions of the player, or even found yourself judging a person based on the characters they play?
Completely. The first time I met you and Pat and Dave was while gaming. You were the GM, so there's not as much judging you based on your characters there because you're playing like 20 different characters. But like Pat, I had no idea what he was like outside of the gaming table. I had no idea what Dave was like outside of the gaming table. So from my perspective, until we got into another game or until we started doing things outside of the table, they were their characters because I didn't know anything better. And I would have the conversation with Chad during the week. It's like, is that Pat or is that Pat's character? Is that Dave or is that Dave's character? Because I have no frame of reference.
And I think another part of that, too, is that it was your first time role playing as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, that same situation would be the same for any person that is a new player into a gaming group. But for you, it's doubly compounded because you had never role played before. So at least like with me, if I were to go into a new group, since I'm a veteran role player, let's say, I already know that, yes, OK, we're role playing and this is the shtick and this is what's going on. But I agree. Until you get to know those people, yeah, you don't really know.
Even if you go in with that mindset and you know it's not what they're really like, you don't know what they are really like.
That's true.
It's the only frame of reference you have.
I don't think it's just new role players. I think it also occurs when there's just a new person in the group because you do not know what that person's like. And so that character is the first real interaction you have with them. I mean, you might BS with them a little bit before or after the game, but if you don't have prolonged social contact with the person, then really all you see of them is that character.
It's your first impression. I mean, that's sort of sociology. You know, when you meet a new person, it's getting the first impressions of them. And in this case, yeah, you're getting the first impressions from a character that they're pretending to play. So that makes it kind of weird.
I think the dangers of this are reduced quite a bit if you have a group that is extensively involved in out-of-character conversations and cross-table talk and all of the things that normally we say is a bad thing at the table. But in this particular case, if it's John across the table and not Ragnar 50% of the time, you're not going to necessarily judge him as much based on Ragnar. You'll judge him based on his actual personality out of character.
You know what really throws me are con games. The first day you'll have a game with someone at, you know, first slot. And then let's say the next day, halfway through the day, you've got another game with them. At that point, I sit down expecting the same person and suddenly there's a different voice. There's a different accent. It's not acting at all like for the first game because it was in character. Oh. And that really messes with your head when you have no frame of reference. And now you're getting competing interactions with this person.
Yeah, the first interaction I had with Mikey Mason, in fact, was I sat down at a gaming table with him. And within 10 minutes of the game starting, he pulled a gun and shot another character in the head. Well, then, how about that?
Wow.
Yeah, I could see Mikey doing that, though.
First time I met him, he was a car.
That's cool, too.
I can see Mikey doing that as well.
Dan's Transformers game, Fear the Con 2. That was the first time I met Mikey, and he's playing a obnoxious, you know, over-the-top car transformer. So actually, I got a pretty good impression of what he was really like right there in the first game.
I think something that has saved our Friday game from falling too far down this is exactly what you're talking about, Johan, is the extensive social interaction during the game. One of my sisters really loves hosting people at her house. So when we get there, I mean, we're used to, you know, snacks. Somebody brings chips or hopefully something a little more healthy and whatnot. But instead, I mean, she'll be like cooking full meals just about. I mean, she really goes all out. And so we will spend sometimes an hour or even 2 hours, which quite frankly is getting to be a bit too much. But nonetheless, we spend a lot of time before the game sitting around talking. And I think that has been critical because there's a lot of people in there that are kind of meeting each other for the first time or interacting seriously for the first time. And if I go around the table, like Adam's character, the one that he's co-playing with my other sister, Christina, his character's kind of a loon and at times kind of burdensome because of that. Scott's character, partially incensed by Christina and Adam's character, is becoming very short and very temperamental. And I can tell, I mean, there's some things going on that are not reflective of the individuals playing those characters. You know, Carla communicated to me straight up that she has to keep reminding herself, this is not who these people really are. But let me throw out something else that I think compounds this further, which is I don't think that's always the case.
I actually agree. And I was just about to say before you moved on to the topic that, yes, indeed, I think that all people that role play, any character that they play, is an extension of that person.
Exactly.
It is a aspect of their personality.
Do you know how many characters there are in a book? One, the author.
Yeah.
That is it. Everything in that book is an extension of the author's imagination, the author's perception of what a certain person would be like, the author's take on how someone would behave in certain circumstances. But as far as the author may try to get from themselves, and the good character authors are the ones who can create a believable distance, but that is still tethered back to themselves. And I have played with people where I firmly believe the obnoxious traits of their characters. And I don't think this is true in my Friday game, just to be clear. I'm not bashing anyone. I do have some people in mind, but my Friday game's not it. But the obnoxious traits of their characters have very much been reflective of negative impulses or problematic behaviors that they try and work out during the game.
Yep. I think the newer the player is, and even more so the younger the player is, the more you see that. It's especially obvious in games with teenagers. I think some of the people, at least in this table, have played role-playing games when they were teenagers, and they probably know what I'm talking about.
Yep.
That is a completely stereotypical example of it. I'm going to kill the shopkeeper. I'm going to burn down the town because he didn't drop his prices by 50% like I told him he was going to.
Wow, I never did that when I was a teenager.
No, hey. Me neither. No, that was somebody else entirely I'm talking about. But
we'll call him Johan for the sake of argument.
Right. To put a little distance there. But this hypothetical Johan person might have done something like that, and it might theoretically have been tied to a hatred of a certain shopkeeper that maybe overcharged him for something the previous day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find a lot of the people that really push that they don't do this are the ones where you really see those traits come out.
Yes.
I'll just throw them out there. Chad. Every character I have seen Chad play, I have seen Chad in that character.
Well, yeah.
It's not the words, it's not necessarily the actions, but he plays them very similarly.
Yeah. Is it the neuroses?
Yeah, and they follow a very similar role within the group. They're always there. They're always the one doing the actions, or they're always ones going out against the rest of the group and things like that. Mm-hmm. And because that's what Chad is. Chad is the action guy that goes out against the rest of the group.
I think just as the adage, a drunk man's words or a sober man's thoughts, I think it's exactly the same with role-playing characters. A character is just, it's a fantasy that the person playing it is living out at the gaming table. It's maybe something that some aspect of their life that they don't get to do, that they're sort of acting out. And I will say that I don't think it's just teenagers, Johan. I think you always do it. And I mean, you can consciously try not to.
I think teenagers just do the worst job of hiding it.
Well, yes.
And
I
even
think so,
some teenagers, not all, but I think, some teenagers.
Teenagers and Chad.
Well, no, because I'm guilty of it, too, as I would say, because
we have our strings
all that way.
Your strings are always children.
Well,
my strings are always animals.
A lot of the times,
any GM running for either one of us knows that they can hit us by our strings. Yeah. I mean, even though our characters may not care about that at all, we as people do, and that's something that's come out in every character that you've played where the situations come up. Children are a big thing for you. For me, it's always been animals.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing necessarily, because that's something the GM can work with.
And all my characters are a permutation of Shug Knight. You know, I think, though, Wayne, you're absolutely onto something, in that the people who are least honest about it are the worst offenders. That's not to say that everyone is immune to the problem. But like most things in life, once you can at least look in the mirror and say, yeah, I'm doing this, you're going to work a little bit to try and get away from it, or you'll start trying to identify those ruts. It's the people that think they don't have this problem who probably have this problem the most.
Right.
Well, and one thing that people will say, to throw it out there, I think Chad is one who says this, is that you don't have to do, you know, you.
This is why Chad should never miss an episode.
Exactly.
Chad not being here, and we just throw him under the bus.
Oh, he'll love it. It's all right. He'll never hear it anyway, so it won't matter.
Just, we'll go ahead and let out the theoretical Johan we were talking about earlier was actually Chad.
But I think, you know, Chad had said that basically, you don't have to role play yourself, because you should be a good enough role player to be a good actor in doing that. And the problem with that is that if you think about it, an actor is reciting words from a page that they've memorized that they didn't write themselves. We sitting at a game table are playing a character that we have created, and we don't have dialogue that's been written for us. So everything that that character does is coming from that player.
Okay, but
that is the difference. Actors play characters that don't reflect the way the actor are, because all actors are stupid anyway. I mean, you know, if you ever notice that, don't ever have actor heroes, because if you ever meet them in real life, you'll be so disappointed how stupid they are. But
okay,
anyway,
after hearing this tirade, Johan, we need you to come and bring Strongbow every week.
Yeah. But again, you know, these actors are doing this because they've got these words in their head that they've memorized and they're regurgitating, and they are playing this character. You are not doing that around the game table. That character is coming straight out of your brain.
But you know what, Pat?
I don't think
even that totally inoculates the actor. Because if you look at, let's take a Shakespearean play. I mean, plays that have been in production for hundreds of years. Why do people tell you to go to a particular production and see a particular actor? It's because they take a character and find some way to make it their own.
Right.
They interpret the character in a way that is unique to their experiences. Let's take something more from pop culture. Let's take the Joker, Mark Hamill, Heath Ledger, Cesar Romero. Was some of that script? Absolutely. Obviously, there was a big difference between the Heath Ledger Joker and the Cesar Romero Joker at the level of script. But I'll bet even if you put those guys all at the same age, on the same part, on the same script, you would end up with a different Joker, simply because they would take that character and interpret it based on their tastes, their experiences, their preferences.
Their willingness to shave their mustache.
You're not disagreeing with me. You're supporting my point in the fact that there is no being a good enough actor that, you know, that you're not playing a part of yourself. You are, because yes, even the actors that do it, they bring something from their life to that character.
Well, let me draw out of this, outside of be honest with yourself, the only bit of true advice I think I can give on the subject, which is, once you have willingly admitted, yes, my characters are all a reflection of self, you cannot make a character that's not a reflection of self. But what you can do is change up which part of yourself you're reflecting.
Yes.
I think what you can do is say, all right, all of my characters fall into this rut. And if you don't know what your annoying ruts are, ask the guy to the right of you at the table, because he will know. Mm-hmm. He's probably been looking for the opportunity to tell you for 15 years.
And so, don't just try to play the opposite of that character, because that's not going to end well.
Right. A great example of this is, there was a guy that I used to game with where every character that he played had to be the super sneaky, sociopathic, cut purse. The little kleptomaniac rogue always had ambidexterity, always had a pistol in each hand or a dagger in each hand, just this obnoxious crap. It was not the fact that this was a reflection of idealized self. It was the fact that he played this particular reflection of idealized self in every game. When his character started to get interesting was when we started taking those characters and writing them for him. And yes, he still interpreted them back to himself, but at least we changed where that tether was. At least we got him off that rut.
Mm. What do you mean, took the characters and wrote them yourself?
What I mean was we got to the point where we got so freaking sick of it that we just finally laid down the law and said, we'll just call him, quote unquote, Tim for the sake of argument. We said, Tim, we can't take these damn hard ass characters anymore. Here's who you're playing this game. And we wouldn't screw him. I mean, the characters were never bad characters. We're just tired of the absurdity of what you're playing. Let us write something for you. In retrospect, it was kind of a dick move. Quite frankly, we were too harsh with him. We were not very patient. We were hyper teenagers just on the opposite side of the equation.
Well, but at the
same
time,
it was not the right way to handle it.
Yeah, okay, maybe it was a little harsh, but at the same time, I think you helped him grow out of the rut that he was in. Like you said, he was just doing the same thing, so you expanded his horizons a little bit that by giving him the opportunities to play different characters, different types of characters, and I think that's a good thing. Actually, one thing I was going to say is, and this is sort of the way I started role-playing, I think a good exercise that people could do, and I know a lot of people are going to balk at this, I think an exercise would be to have a campaign where each player plays multiple characters in the same game. That's actually how I started. I started where I was playing three or four characters and the other guy was playing three or four characters. So we had this big group of players, but it was only the two of us playing.
What I think that you allowed physically us to hurt do, Johan.
Oh, I know. And I said, yeah. People are going to just go apeshit over this, but the thing, what it's going to do is that if you've got different characters with different personalities, you're going to be forced to be playing different aspects of self in these and exploring that way, instead of you just got one character and it's just the same thing over and over again.
No, you're going to have four characters with one personality and four sets of stats.
Well, nine times out of ten. In my case, I think it was actually a worthwhile experience. It can teach them to do something different.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're just playing one character at a time, you get rid of this character, you go on to the next one. It's so much easier to just go, boom, carbon copy, different name.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from with it, and I could see where it could work. It's just that in my experience, and we've done this lots of times in various campaigns that I've ran and played in, it's never once worked out that way. Mm. It's always been either I have two characters that you can't really tell the difference between, except that they have different stats and a different name, or I have one character and I have a body shield. And that's what it's amounted to in almost any group that has ever done that, unfortunately.
There are a couple things we've tried or talked about, and two of these we've tried, one of these we've talked about, that have worked out pretty well for us. One of them is the GM makes the characters and everyone either draws one randomly or gets to pick from a couple. So maybe you get to draw a character. If you don't like it, you can throw it back. But if you throw it back, you have to play the next one that you draw.
I instinctively feel averse to that. Unless it's a con game, the idea of not having a part of the creation of the character from the beginning really bugs me. It's like you're taking away the one thing I'm bringing to the table.
I don't entirely disagree with you. I think there is some virtue to doing it and that it challenges your ruts. But I think you are absolutely right that it does take away the one bit of true creativity a player gets to have in the course of the game.
Something that I've considered doing, but I've never tried, that might be a middle ground on this, is to take either a book on Jungian psychology or a copy of The Hero's Journey and assign everyone an archetype and then say, make your character, but it's got to fit the archetype.
I got to stop you right there. Assign a what?
An archetype.
A what?
Fat's going to be
what,
mad.
Chad?
Fat's going to be mad until you say archetype.
You mean an archetype?
The archetype. Go on.
The archetype. Yes.
My classiest of pronunciations.
Yes.
Now, my preference, both in what we've done as well as looking at other systems like, say, Fate and some of these others, I like the idea of the other players helping to create the character.
That was possibility number two, is you do a form of collaboration where everyone at the table gets together and makes the other guy's character. So let's say this was a gaming group. Wayne, Pat, and Johan would make my character. Johan, Wayne, and I would make Pat's character.
See, that's too far for me even. What I like is
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the way we did it even with the magic cards. But someone creates their basic character concept, their idea, and then other people are contributing to that, and they're contributing to everyone else's. Mm-hmm. That, I think, gives people, you know, I give Pat the aspect of this. Well, that's something he's not used to, something he's not familiar with. It gives him something to play around with, but at the core of it, it's still the character he created, and now he gets to look at it and say, okay, I kind of like playing with that.
Yeah.
I think that you're in this rut, so I'm giving you this aspect.
Yeah, I would call that a true brainstorming approach to doing the character, since it's more of a collaborative around the table thing.
It would help the group template as well, because at that point, the other players at the table are helping to give the backstory of the character, tie them together, throw out these concepts. Like, in, for example, Dresden Files, looking through the book of it, each player actually describes how they guest starred in the first adventure of another player.
That sounds like something from Lovecraft, the book of it.
Anyway, that's just all over all of our heads. We've got no clue what you're referencing.
Okay. Anyway, then, Fleet Week. The other one that we thought about, and I think this, like the other ones, has the same issue of it takes away that bit of creativity from the player, was everybody makes a character and then passes it one to the right or one to the left, or puts it in a big pile and then redraws from it, where you roll up the stats, but you also write a paragraph of personality, paragraph two of background, and then you pass them around. So that way, once again, it's still your interpretation, but at least it breaks your rut. But
for me, the ideal situation is the players are assisting each other with their character creation and the world creation for the GM as well. I like the players having that input, and I think it helps the GM too if they're helping to build the world.
Well, and I think here's the great challenge to the player. If you want to solve this problem without sacrificing control of your character, is just ask your group, what is my rut? What kind of thing would you like to see me play? Here's my character. What do you guys honestly not like? Or phrase it in a more positive way, what could I do to make him better? And ferret those out yourself.
And to tie all this together, if your character is a jerk, you probably are too. Go seek help.
Or not, if you're comfortable with being a jerk.
Well, or if your characters are consistently jerks, that probably says more about you than it does about the rest of the world. So, All right, Wayne, we're going to very loosely tie these two topics together. And believe you me, this is going to be a weak-ass tie-in. But you were talking about the Dresden Files, which got you thinking about a topic that we are going to move to next.
Yeah, it's one you guys have talked about before. Well, I say you guys. No one on the mic here except for you was on that episode.
It's 193 episodes ago.
Yeah, it's the concept of playing in an established setting, particularly someone else has established this world. In this case, it was Dresden Files. Star Wars, Star Trek, whatever, established property. That's really what got me thinking about it. As I'm reading through the Dresden Files book, I'm getting all excited about, you know, the game. My wife is getting really excited about the idea of possibly playing it. And it got me thinking about what are the pitfalls of it. I've never actually done this outside of a con game. So
let me give you my bird's eye view of it, and then we'll drill down to a bunch of details. My bird's eye view of it is good in that it helps you to not have to write all the little details for every place and everything. You have some kind of a starting point from which to work. However, having said that, I tend to always stick to the fringes. I very rarely go to the popular places or follow the more well-known plot points within that universe. And I'll get to why here in a little bit. But Johan and Pat, I'm curious what your guys' opinion on this is.
My approach to it is, A, I almost never run a campaign set in a place that the players know well. Not because I have a personal rule against it, it just hasn't happened.
And that would include fictional settings, I presume.
That would include fictional settings, right. Yes. Which makes it a little easier for me because I can simply use an established setting as a fallback. It allows me to make a story like I normally will, but I won't have to make any backup details. So if the party suddenly goes off the tracks and goes to a town that I don't have anything planned for that town, I can whip out a campaign book, point to a random town and say, "Whoa, that town's there now." And I've got what I need to run a convincing town that fits within the setting of the world.
You know, I think that would work even better if the players don't know the established setting.
That's exactly
maybe you've
what
got
saying.
One guy, but mm-hmm. the rest of them don't. At that point, they don't know what you just made up and what was already there.
Right. It does not work. Or I don't think it would work nearly as well if the players actually seriously understand the setting. And I have not run a game like that, but I have played in a game like that. It was unpleasant.
All right, well, you guys are sort of taking it from the GM perspective, and I'm going to give it to you from a player's perspective. I actually think that playing in an established setting is great. I've done it. That's how I started role-playing. I actually started role-playing the Dragonlance series, and that's actually the one where I played multiple characters. And I'm going to up the ante. The multiple characters that we played were the heroes from the book.
Yeah.
And some others. So yeah, and I've even gone a step farther than that. We knew the setting and it was great. And here's the thing. You guys are talking about challenges from a GM standpoint, and I respect that. I am totally cool with that. But on the flip side, as a player, I want to go to these places I've read about in the book. I want to experience them. Take Star Wars. I want to experience, you know, the Rebel base, or I want to experience Coruscant and be immersed in that setting or something like that. In Dragonlance, mm-hmm. I want to get a Dragonlance and slay dragons. I want to play Huma.
Oh boy.
You know, that kind of thing. It's one of those things. I think what you have to do is it's what do your players want to do?
Absolutely.
I mean, do they want to do that? If they do, great. Do it. You know, you should,
all right,
you should try it. If you don't want to do that, then that's too damn bad. That's what your players want.
Let's see if you brought your A game tonight or not, because man, I don't even know where to start. I got to pick some place. So
let's start with playing established characters, because that is one of my questions. If someone at your table really wants to play a character that is in the established setting, whether it be a main character, someone that's been in the spotlight, or just a backup character, a bartender or something, do you let them do that?
Let me start this whole conversation with a disclaimer that what follows is my opinion, what I want out of a game. Pat, you are absolutely right that the number one objective of any game is for the people around the table to have fun. If you are having fun doing a tour of an existing setting and being there when Luke blows up the Death Star or whatever, that is perfectly fine. You are doing nothing wrong. Everything that follows is what I want out of my game. Pat, that D&D game you just described makes me want to kill myself and take a truckload of puppies with me.
You know, I
just want to say,
it's over the top for me, but I see some potential in it in that I like the idea of an established setting for the players.
Wait, stop. I just cannot.
I think you've almost left him speechless at this point.
All right, Wayne.
That would be a more impressive feat if it was Chad.
All right, Wayne, we'll start with your thing. Did you want to talk about playing established characters or running into established characters?
I want to talk about playing it. If someone in your party wants to play an established character. If you're a player and someone else wants to be an established character, is that going to bother you as a player? The whole gambit.
My take on this is the starting point for any sort of campaign that's going to be based in an established setting, especially if you're going to be interacting with or playing established characters, is the entire table needs to sit down and have a discussion about how canonical is this game going to be.
Yes.
If I'm playing in a Star Wars game that happens between, say, episodes 2 and 3, the real episodes 2 and 3, we're talking 5 and 6, between Empire and Jedi.
Oh, I got you, yeah.
And I kill Darth Vader. Can that happen? And that needs to be established right up front. If I'm playing as Han Solo and Han Solo dies, is that allowed to happen?
Describe that way. I've both played run-in and can fully accept a game taking place in a pre-generated setting. When I run D&D, one of my favorite things to do is to run it in Forgotten Realms. I take an old box set that goes back to about the time of like the gold box games. And I basically say, first of all, the only truth I am using is the truth that's in the two little booklets that came with that box set. I don't care what Ed Greenwood wrote. I don't care what came before or after. Whatever's in these books is what I'm going with. It's enough to save me having to describe towns. But I know there are people at the table in some of these campaigns I've run who have read all those novels, read all the books, know more about it than I do. And I'm just saying up front, it's not canon. All this place is doing is filling in the blanks for me. I am departing from it thereafter. Because in my mind, if there is a canon, and especially if we're talking about a present and future canon that is immutable, why play the game? And doubly so, why be there? Why be at the Death Star if you cannot have any impact on what occurs there? If you are fundamentally just doing nothing but running around hallways, doing inconsequential things anyway, why not move the campaign somewhere else where you can do consequential things?
Well, there's various reasons why you might do that. For one thing, not every campaign is based around world-altering consequential events. You can have a campaign that's set on the Death Star that has nothing to do with the destruction of the Death Star.
Then why does it have to be at the Death Star at all?
Because the Death Star is awesome.
It's a place of reference. I mean, that's one thing coming into a game. If you don't know the world that you're playing in or this setting, it sometimes throws you because you don't know where you can go or what you can do. But I think that also can be a bad thing in that, going back to our Skies of Glass game, that was set in a real city that I know decently well, Cape Girardeau. So the whole time we're playing it, my mind is showing me Cape of today. And I'm thinking, what's there? Where can I go? When that's not the world that you've set up in this case. So at that point, that was working against me. And I think you may have that happen in some of these kind of settings where people, if they know this world so well, if they know the Death Star, for example, mm-hmm. they expect on floor 23, there's going to be this. So I'm going to floor 23.
And that's perfectly fine if everybody at the table sets down with the same expectations. If everybody there knows the layout of the Death Star and their characters should know the layout of the Death Star, if they're all maintenance workers who work for the Empire and are just chilling and doing their jobs and whatever happens that makes it an interesting game happens, then everyone should know the layout of the Death Star. It's perfectly appropriate that they do.
And for me, that's a helpful thing. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, you're allowed to focus on your character development, what you're doing, and you don't have to do some of the basics of, well, would I know where this is? Do I know where this is? Hey, Dan, where is this? Because I really don't know.
Right.
All of that is in the background. All of the setting stuff is kind of in the background at that point because you just know it and you can focus on what you really want to focus on.
And once again, phrased that way, I don't have a problem with it. Using the setting as a common frame of reference. This is why Carl is willing to play Star Trek but struggles with other games because she feels overwhelmed. But Star Trek, she knows a lot about. She knows how a Klingon's going to act when she runs into one. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know how some random alien out of some less known sci-fi universe is going to behave when she runs into one. But my problem is that more often than not, when you end up playing in an established setting, it becomes a damn setting wike. And my issue is I care far more about my character and the GM story than I do about how cool it is to be standing on the Death Star next to Han Solo. I just don't give a crap. And I have had GMs where that was the game. Well, you walk into, and this got really bad in some D&D games, you walk into such and such a town and you see Elminster, and they pause and look at you expectantly, and it's like, in 3 seconds I'm supposed to give a f-? I mean, it's like, what is the countdown here? Yeah, okay, we were chasing this guy. Great, good for him. What does he want, a medal? And that's what it becomes. It becomes a damn setting wank.
That runs into one of my fears with using established characters, particularly having someone in the party play it. If everyone in the party's playing it, then you've got this problem with everyone. But if only one person's playing it, it's a matter of, I know this established character. Let's say we're playing Star Wars and Pat wants to play Han Solo. At that point, I know this is what Han Solo personality is. Let's say Pat decides, okay, I'm tired of doing this. I'm going to sell the Millennium Falcon to the Empire and I'm going to go off and join Darth Vader and become his apprentice. Well,
Han Solo wouldn't do that. Everyone knows that.
We've now gone into bad fanfic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And you want to see this quadrupled. Play in that game where Pat's playing Han Solo and the GM is a massive Han Solo fan. And watch the game implode from there.
And I have to say, normally I don't have any problem thinking about, well, is this other player across the table from me? Is his action in character? If I had known the character from movies or books or something, I don't know that that wouldn't come into my mind. Because reading a book, sometimes you wonder, was that really in character?
Personally, I think that if you're going to play established characters, if they're going to be allowed in the game, I think that everyone playing should play established characters. Like you're saying, it shouldn't just be out of four players around the table, one person is playing one of the established people. I think that that way, if everybody's doing it, or at least most people are, maybe you've got a little bit more of a checks and balances system there. Like if you were to play Luke against my Han, you could sort of call me out on that because, hey, you know what? We interacted that way.
Yeah, but going back,
I mean, so that could help it
going
somewhat.
Back halfway into the previous topic, I'm curious what the difference is between that and somebody else at the table writing your character. Because, you know, one of the points that you guys raised was you prefer to write your own character because you like to have the hand in the creation. But what is the difference between playing Han Solo or playing some random guy that I wrote for you?
Because we didn't get to pick the random guy. If you assign a random Star Wars character,
okay, that's fair enough.
It's plus, different than I want to play Han Solo.
That's fair enough.
Plus, I don't want to play Han Solo.
Well,
I'm saying I don't want him to play Han Solo either. Unless everyone is playing that.
You know, then I don't think that you would want to play in a game where people were playing established characters.
Well, there's also,
but if you're going to do that, I think that everybody should.
There's also a definite difference in power level. I mean, if you look at any game that has established characters and it comes with stat sheets for the established characters,
they're usually half step below God.
Yeah. They are way above and beyond what you could possibly come up with at character creation.
And again, I mean,
they're just massively out of the power scale of the rest of the characters.
And there again, that's why I say you should start from scratch, because that's what we did in my example that I'm soulless and I'm going to hell for whatever reason. I don't quite understand still, but we'll get to that later. What we were doing, it's not that we were playing at any given time in the Dragonlance world or playing around these events or whatever. It's that we decided we like these characters. They were fun in the books that we read. We know these characters. we started them off at first level.
Mm-hmm.
They were not all powerful, godlike characters. We were two guys playing these characters. We know their personalities because we freaking read the books. So we were playing those personalities in the game, starting from the beginning and doing random adventures and doing whatever sounded fun. And, you know, what the GM threw at us, we were doing stuff that it had nothing to do with canon. It wasn't an issue of anyone being too powerful. We were all first level, progressing onward to whatever. I mean, that's the way we went at it. Now, obviously, people can go different ways, because I know one of the things that we also ran through at that time is, and I don't know how you pronounce it correctly, but I say Drizzt, the drow with the two swords. Everybody wanted to play that character, and they all want to play because it's just a horrible wank. And that was even beyond me.
Yes.
But, you know,
anytime there's a Forgotten Realms game, there's always a drow with two swords.
Absolutely.
You can't escape it.
No, it's inescapable. Just like the bad writing of, we won't go there.
So, Dan, you said earlier that your fear of having established characters, even in the background, is that it becomes the tour of the universe. Do you avoid using the characters at all?
Very much so. Their names might get mentioned, if necessary, somewhere in the background. If I'm playing a Star Wars game, well, let's get off Star Wars. Let's say I'm running a Star Trek game.
Way to branch out there, Dan. I'm sorry, it's just funny.
Let me just start at that. Star Wars and Star Trek are totally the same. Pat at feartheboot.com.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, let's say not Star Wars, Star what? What could, what Star?
Also,
Star,
a board Star cube Wars, could Star totally Trek. Destroy the Death Star. All right.
If somebody goes around and asks, are they going to be aware of the named characters, that the fact that there is an Enterprise out there somewhere on the fleet roster? If they go back to Starfleet Command, there are named characters established in the movies that run Starfleet. Yeah. Absolutely.
Because that would be one of my big fears, but is that people would avoid that. You know, as I was thinking about the whole Dresden Files thing, that was one thing. There's an established setting. There is a Wizarding Council. There are wardens. And I had that fear of, if someone's running the game and they have that mindset of, I don't want established characters because I don't want it to be bad fanfic, and they might go out of their way, which would hurt the game even more, in my opinion.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think my problem is that it is very hard for someone running a well-established game, especially if they're a fan of it, to say established setting item, comma. It is always established setting item, period. Han Solo shows up. This is a self-contained idea. It's not you happen to be somewhere and he happens to be somewhere. No, when he's there, he is the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my problem with it. Wayne, the exact phrase that I've used in previous episodes to describe this phenomenon is the Tour de Realms. We played a D&D game, I think it was a Ravenloft game, where we were just taken from one place to the next, and there was really no plot, except we were supposed to go to these various towns and be in awe of the fact that we were someplace special.
I would hate that, because I've never read Ravenloft.
Neither had I. And neither did anyone else in the game. And quite frankly, we didn't care. What we were invested in was our characters, our story, the plot we thought we were a part of. And instead, we were just supposed to go around and feel special because we were tourists in an imaginary place none of us really were anyway.
You know, that's really the sad thing to hear you tell that story, because, you know, if the person running that game has that in mind, but the players don't know it, he's missing out on an opportunity. You bring him to that situation, you need a location, you need a person, you've got it pre-made there for you. You don't have to come up with any of it. And the players never know that it's not something you came up with.
But, you know, use them in their proper context. This is where I would say, look, if I'm in a game and Darth Vader's in there, I accept Darth Vader's going to be hard to kill. If I'm playing Ravenloft and Strahd's in there, I understand Strahd's going to be really freaking hard to kill. But if I pull it off, it should be possible. There should be nothing in the setting I can't avert. If I put a TIE fighter between Luke and his proton torpedo, guess what? The Death Star didn't get blown up, or he had to take a second pass, one of the two. But the point being, you know, and I want to feel like I can do something in the setting that matters. And I do have to admit, Wayne, that probably part of my total recoiling at this is because I've been burned so bad by it in the past. I would not go so far as to say it can't be done right. I will just say that to date, I have personally not been in a game where it was done right, where it was put in its proper context of, look, these are a part of the setting. They're a real part of the setting. We're not going to pretend they don't exist. We're not going to pretend they don't matter. But the universe does not revolve around them.
As a group that talks a lot about trying to get new players into the hobby, I think if you don't talk about established settings, you're missing a potential great tool for bringing people into the hobby. You know, you've mentioned Carla is not into some of these other games, but she's willing to play Star Trek. My wife is ecstatic about the idea of playing Dresden Files. Pad, he's talking about his first game was a setting that he knew as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a huge opportunity to bring them into this world. You like Star Trek? You can be on a starship. if you're avoiding it because you're afraid of it becoming fanfic, you might not get the player to try it to begin with that could eventually enjoy the hobby.
But out of perspective, you can also drive them away because you can use those established setting elements as a way of subconsciously telling them the things you do don't matter. You are always going to exist in the shadow of this other person, at which point I think they're going to ask the same question I did of, look, if you're really just trying to tell the story of Star Wars, why don't we just sit down and watch the movies? Why do I need to have you describe to me what I already saw in the theaters when I was a little kid?
One thing I've seen done that works, at least it has worked and may work for others, is to have something right off the bat that violently diverges your campaign from the established canon. For example, Star Trek game, sit down at the first session, you get a call from Starfleet, the Enterprise was just destroyed by Romulans, you're the new flagship, go.
Yeah, and it's for real. It's not, they were sucked into another dimension, their bodies are...
they're gone. Yeah. It's destroyed.
You know what, I guess to put this back into movie context, it'd be like what J.J. Abrams did with the Star Trek 11 film that they just called Star Trek, where within the first however much of the movie, you know, I guess I won't spoil it because it's new enough, somebody may not have seen it, but he radically changes the canon of plot within that universe.
Right.
I mean, almost, well, actually does right off the bat and does it several times over before the movie's over.
I would have a problem with the game for the same reason that I had the same problem with that Star Trek movie. I don't think it's necessary for me. And I think I'm the only geek in the world that didn't like that Star Trek movie.
I didn't dislike it, but I wasn't a huge fan either.
And what I disliked about it was, I don't think it was necessary to tie it into previous. This is a new thing that should be able to stand on its own. Why do you have to do those tie-ins? The story to me suffered greatly by having done the tie-in. And I think if I sat down at a game and the first thing I got was a message that the Enterprise has been destroyed and I'm the new flagship, I might have that same reaction. But then again, I'm not a new player sitting down to play for the first time. I'm someone who's played at least a couple campaigns through now, and I have that in the mindset. I know going in that even if it's an established setting, I can do whatever I want, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you that GM, do you guys find it more intimidating to run an established game when other people at the table know a whole hell of a lot more about it than you do?
Yes. It's awful.
Yeah, I hesitate.
I won't do it.
I won't say I won't do it, but I will only do it under two circumstances. First, I will tell the people, look, straight up, I'm diverging from setting. Like I said earlier, I don't care what you've read. This is what I'm doing. And secondly, I will not brook setting lawyering, which is just as bad as rules lawyering.
Yeah. Even if I set those rules, I could never run a Skies of Glass game for you, Dan, because that was your setting.
You know, I've had the same problem for years with multiple games. While I, by no stretch of the imagination, wrote the setting, I did contribute a few minor parts to canon. But even that aside, I just knew it really well. It was years, and I mean many years, like probably a decade or more before anyone would run a Battletech game for me. To this day, I can't get anyone to run a Skies of Glass game for me, or, and I guess this one's no shock, but an Apocrysos game for me. For the same reason, I would love to play in all the above games. Nobody will run them for me. And I'm not a setting lawyer. I have even told these people, look, I will consult with you on the setting if you're interested, but if you say such and such, I'm not going to contradict you. We'll just accept this is your game. It may not be part of my canon, but it's your game. And even still, people just won't do it. And I understand why. I totally understand why.
I've been on the player side in a campaign that went totally off the rails because one of the other players was basically GMing from the player's seat. Oh, we're going to go to this place where, yes, I know this guy is, and I can talk to him in this way, and he will respond in this fashion because everyone knows that's how he is. And then since we're dealing with this type of bad guy, we're going to go to this city because there's a wizard there that hates undead. And that's why I won't do it.
It's
that campaign.
Yep. I've experienced that as well.
That to me is what leads to bad fan fiction. And I'm not saying all fan fiction's bad, just every piece I've ever read. And I don't want my game to come out like that, but I like the idea of having the setting anyway.
You know what, Wayne? What makes bad fan fiction? It's not telling a story set in somebody else's sandbox. That's not bad fan fiction. That's just you contributing to their universe. It's bad fan fiction when you take their setting and wank to it, or you take yourself, project it into their setting, and wank to it. It comes from that projected wank, and that is exactly what I've seen go wrong too many times in role-playing games.
You know, a lot of the bad fanfic that I have seen has been more things that people wanted to see happen in the show that would have never actually happened. This is bigger, and we must have big sweeping changes. And I think you could run into that with a role-playing game as well. If you're trying to run this game, you're trying to establish that these big things can happen because it's not the canon, you could run into the same problem. Oh, well, the Star Bridge is destroyed in a Transformers game. The Enterprise is destroyed first thing. And you're making all these big sweeping changes that leave the players wondering, why are we even playing in this world?
Well, I guess that though depends on how you define the setting. I mean, in my mind, Star Trek's a hell of a lot bigger than Kirk and Spock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a setting where we're moving half a dozen characters, just completely empties the setting of any significance, you had a bad setting to begin with.
And it's not the removing of the characters, it's taking the time to do it, I think. Why does Kirk even need to be in your Star Trek game? Why does Picard even need to be in it?
Yeah, once again, they'll be on a fleet manifest somewhere, but they just don't really show up. They're out there somewhere, but you're doing your own thing that has nothing to do with them. And I've seen this just as much with homebrews. I played in a guy's homebrew, and it was a great homebrew, don't get me wrong. But one of the things that annoyed me was that setting hinged on a very small number of characters. And if you took those characters out of the setting at first, and he later developed beyond this and had a lot of stories to tell, but at first he really wasn't sure what stories to tell anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know what? You can go through human history, and yeah, if you took certain people out of human history, things would have gone very differently. But human history would have still gone on. The setting of Earth does not cease to exist because Churchill and Hitler weren't born.
There are definitely settings that make it very difficult, some of which even have published role-playing games that I don't know how people can play. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is the one that springs directly to mind.
I think that one can be pretty easy to play. You don't have to play Buffy. There are many other Slayers throughout the universe.
Only if you do it after the end of the series. But so
if you do it before, it could just be any one of a number of non-named Slayers. It would be hard to do a modern game in that world without completely throwing away established characters, though. I see what you're saying with that, but
with no Hellmouth, no Buffy, no main cast, there is no world of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I mean, there's no setting outside of Sunnydale.
I think there are, but part of that is because I was a big fan. I've read a lot of the comic books as well, and I watched Angel, and I've seen more established setting outside of the TV show.
Well, it's because to write the rest of it, they had to expand the setting.
Yes.
Right.
It, just like a role-playing game would not be possible if all you had was the first season or two of Buffy, or even going way back, the movie with Christy Swanson and Paul Reubens, there would not be a role-playing game possible. For the exact same reasons that spinoff series and comic books were not possible. And so in order to fix the latter, they had to fix the former.
I want to play Spike.
Wayne, your earlier point about using these as gateway games. Now, as much as I've railed against them, you know, as I've been saying, I don't per se have an issue with using established setting. It's the way they tend to be employed.
You support these as long as you're not playing it up.
Well, you know what? I think...
Yeah, he's all over the map in this one. I don't know what the hell he's talking about anymore.
My issue is not with established settings. My issue is with set pieces within the setting and established characters.
We're just going to call you Chad for the rest of the episode.
But you do bring up a great point about the ability to use these things as gateway games, which I think bears emphasis. If you know someone who's not a fan of role-playing games, never tried role-playing games, but they are a fan of something else, Star Trek, Dresden Files, who knows what, then this is a great way to draw them into the hobby, because you can say, look, here's something you enjoy. Let's try it out and see if you like it or not. But let's move beyond that, because I think that's a point that's fairly straightforward. I don't think that really requires a lot of explanation. But you raised the question prior to the show of, let's say I find someone who's a huge Dresden Files fan, who's never played an RPG, and I convince them to play the Evil Hat Dresden Files game. Now, this game's over. How do I move them from that into other role-playing games, into other aspects of the hobby, where maybe they don't have that same extrinsic interest?
Well, I think that comes with just the discussion around the table from while you're doing that game. I mean, and again, this is for you guys. You like to play these shorter duration campaigns.
No, we don't. We just keep sabotaging.
Well, okay. But even when they're not sabotaged, you still have more of an arc that you want to get through, that it's a finite game. But anyway, while you're playing that, you can talk about these things. And, you know, as you're experiencing this new thing with new players, they're probably going to be exposed to other things just from common interests. Oh, you guys like Dresden Files. Well, have you checked out this? Or, oh, you like science fiction. What do you think about Star Wars or Star Trek along those lines? And say, hey, well, why don't we try this? Or, you know what? Now that we've tried this with these established characters, why don't we try making up our own characters now? Because again, that was exactly what, like you said, that's exactly what happened for me, is when I got hooked, as you say, I got hooked into role playing by playing established characters in the Dragonlance game. That's how they hooked me. And it was a gateway game to the other role playing. And I've been addicted ever since.
Damn, Tracy Hickman.
I know.
The first race is free.
That's it. They give you the first one for free, and then you just keep coming back for more and more.
Yeah, I think what might be helpful is for the second game, go with something where they're helping to create the setting. Okay, you've played this, you enjoyed it. What did you really like? What kind of world would you like to play in? Let's say we weren't playing Star Trek. We weren't playing Star Wars. We weren't playing Dresden. What would you want to be? Do you want to be a guy with a sword? Do you want to be a guy with a machine gun? What would you like to try? And just pick what you're going to do based on that. Cater to them for their second game. And once they've had two games catered to them, do whatever you want for the third.
Yeah, I think if you get someone where no other title will tempt them, I don't think you ever created a new role player to begin with. I mean, I think you had
a fan of an intellectual property.
Yeah, who just was willing to do this because they are collecting everything. They've done everything else, Buffy, so they did the role-playing game, but really they're not interested in RPGs. They just wanted to experience that universe in all of its facets, and this just so happened to be one of them.
I don't think anyone would play the Buffy role-playing game with me, but I would do it.
I'd play with you, Wayne.
I'd
play Spike.
Once again, WoW. Dan is left.
I'll play WoW too.
So,
are we really going to go there? You want to start talking about WoW? Really?
No, we're not going to go there. Not right now. In fact, we're going to stop the episode before it does. So once again, fearthecon.com. Be sure to get out there, get your activity set up, start signing up. We would love to see all you guys there in March of 2011. And I will also link to the place on the forums where people are talking about ride sharing and room sharing. So
unfortunately, Ruinster did already take all the good slots and all the good games.
You know what? So you can't be the first ticket purchaser, but you can be the last ticket purchaser. So, you know, just like the Chilean miners, you can be the last. That's still out there for you. And you'll be all kinds of famous.
That's deep.
Yeah, it really is. But you know what we're going to do? What we're going to do in this case is you think you're going to be the last person to buy a ticket, but right when you get there, we're going to be sold out.
No. I do think this year, to make things a little bit easier on us, I'm probably going to cut off ticket sales and event sign up a few days before the con, so I'm not having to do last minute printing. But you still have plenty of time. You've got lots of time. I mean, it'll still stay open through early March. But don't wait around too long because there are games that will come and go. You know, Bob Arnn's games fill it fast. So anyway, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Later.
Bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.